you want to have a huge impact, you have to be comfortable giving up control. I give up all the control because people will surprise you. Yes, they'll mess up. Everybody does. We all do. But the amount of times they come and they have wowed you because you gave them permission, you gave them a chance. I've had many more of those experiences than bad ones. But if you don't have the relationship and trust with your people, then it's very hard to do that.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, everybody. This is Ben Morton, and welcome to another episode of the podcast. Welcome to episode 67. In this episode, we are joined by Jane Finette, who is an author, a leadership expert, and the founder and executive director of the Coaching Fellowship, a non-profit organisation dedicated to the development of young women leaders in social change. Prior to this, she was a big tech executive at Mozilla and eBay, who has dedicated her life to achieving equality for women, empowering them to create impact across the world. Jane's passion, expertise, and two decades of experience is anchored at the intersection of technology and human potential. At her core, though, she empowers individuals and communities to solve the world's largest, most persistent and perennial problems. Jane is the author of the book Unlocked: How Empowered Women Empower Women, which is a referendum on women's inequality and a toolkit for leveling the playing field for women and girls. It's part inspiration, part practical guide. Unlocked was written to encourage and empower women to take action into their own hands and to reach gender equality in our lifetime. But for now, let's get back to this episode, which is actually much longer than most because my conversation with Jane just kept on flowing. We spent a lot of time discussing authentic leadership and how we can learn from others while still being true to who we are and what we stand for as leaders. We also went back to her time at Mozilla and looked at creating a culture, empowering and leading people when they don't actually work for you. And as you would probably expect, we also explored her mission to level the playing field for women in the world of work. So, without any further delay, please enjoy my conversation with Jane Finette. Jane, a very warm welcome to the podcast. It's fantastic to have you with us today. First of all, how are you?
Hey, Ben. Thank you. Happy New Year. I am doing great. Thank you. And I'm so happy to be in conversation with you today. I should give you some context. So, you know, I live in Boulder in Colorado, and just last Thursday, we got another foot of snow. So it's pretty snowy out there, but the sun is always shining here in Boulder. So it's a beautiful but chilly morning.
I'm quite jealous, actually. Like Boulder is one of those places on my wish list that I'd love to come visit and explore and be in the great outdoors there. So.
Yeah. And you have to look me up when you come out this way.
Absolutely. I'll do that. I'll take you up on that offer.
Please.
So, Jane, listeners now will be getting familiar with the very first question I like to ask every guest on the show, which is perhaps a simple question to ask, but not so simple to answer. And that really is, what does leadership mean to you?
I love this question. And, you know, leadership to me it's a tofu word because it's going to, you know, tofu on its own, it doesn't taste like anything. And so it's always what flavor do you add to the tofu, right, that it becomes. And so my version of the leadership tofu is, for me, leadership is about helping everyone around you live out their full potential. And in doing so, help them themselves become leaders and help everyone else also live their full potential.
I love that. When you started talking about leadership being a tofu word, I thought you was going to go down the Marmite route, which in the UK, we talk about you either love it or you hate it. It's like, where are we going to go with it?
Well, how about you with Mark? Where are you? Me too. Yeah, I love it. It's good for you as well. It's very good for you, apparently. All those riboflavins. I don't know. They did good marketing with Marmite, I think. Yeah,
they certainly did. Yeah, but I love that definition because that really opens up the infinite possibilities to put our own stamp on leadership and be our true authentic self and not being fixed to one style or particular type of leadership, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I completely agree because I think we can be conditioned to think, oh, I need to emulate this person, or leadership looks like blank. So, you know, leadership could be, I have to manage people. And then not only manage people, but I need to manage X amount of people. And we're really, in my humble opinion, in my version of the tofu, none of that really matters, you know. And so much of it for me is also starting with, are you a leader of your own life to begin with? You know, are we in control? Are we in full choice? Are we in full awareness? And then we get to realize what is the manifestation of how we want to lead and what is the purpose of why we're leading in the world. But I love that you said that because it is absolutely different for everyone, as it should be. And but that does mean we're all on our own leadership journey too. So it can be a bit hard at times, I think.
And I think that's fascinating as well. You mentioned being the leader of your own life there, because I think arguably, if we're not doing that, if we're not leading our own life and living our own life, I guess, on purpose and intentionally and clear about what's really important for us and what we stand for, then as I say, arguably, how can we be that effective kind of leading anybody else?
Yeah, well, people talk about sort of awakening, you know, and getting sort of underneath everything, you know, that it's not just about hitting your goals and it's not just about X amount of revenue targets and things like this. And when we get away from, but why does this matter? The sort of the for the sake of what? And I suppose that comes a bunch with age as well. But I think when we're younger, we can just get very caught up in, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. And we've forgotten about, or we haven't even considered, who are we being at that same time? And so, and I do think that leaders who are really creating the most impact and are themselves most fulfilled are those that are holding both the doing the work, because if we're not doing it, we're not having impact and we're not creating change, whatever that is for you. But if we're not also being at the same time, then we're losing that purposefulness and a reason for doing it. And when we do, wow, we better get the heck out of our way, right? Then we're on fire and we're ready to, you know, bring people with us, like, as well. Like, that's, I think, really enigmatic, and people want to follow you when you are in alignment.
Yeah, that really resonates with me, Jane. And maybe in 10 minutes, we might get on to some of the questions that we planned
for. It was a big question.
Talk about.
It was, wasn't it? It was. I love it.
I love what you were sharing there around doing and being, which was really one of the reasons why I set up my leadership development business. And I use the word doing in a slightly different context here, but essentially we're talking about the same thing, I think, in that I suddenly got to the point in my corporate career where for a lot of the corporate leadership and development and training programs I saw taking place, I started to get this sense that organizations were teaching people to do leadership. Mm-hmm. It was leadership through the application of a series of tools and models and frameworks. And here's a five-step model or process for influencing people. And here's a four-step process for handling difficult conversations. And it moved away from, I guess, true, authentic leadership. Who are you? What do you stand for? How are you going to be? How are you going to show up as a leader? Versus just being this person who's applying a whole load of models and tools to people, which starts to feel like you're being manipulated, in my experience.
Yes, it sounds like the sort of the mechanization of leading, right? And that there appears to be a sort of a cookie cutter approach that everyone is the same. And so if we all learn the same tools, then we can all have the same output. And we're much more complex humans, and our intersectionality and how our past experiences and who we are in the world. So it's going to mean different things to different people. So, and we really lose something, I think, when we don't allow people to bring all of themselves into their work. Yeah, I love that you're doing that work, Ben. It's so necessary in the workplace. It desperately is.
Yeah, thank you. I think it's, again, it's interesting. I keep using this word. Are you talking about how we are all complex and different beings, right? Again, there's so many leadership programs where you can go on where one of the first things you do is start to talk about sort of a famous leader or a sort of celebrity leader, and we try and replicate and model what they do. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm an avid reader. I love reading biographies and business books. But there's a danger, isn't there, that we can fall into the trap of trying to copy that particular famous leader. Like here in the UK, the one people often talk about is Sir Richard Branson or somebody like that. And suddenly we're trying to like be our version of Richard Branson. But Richard Branson's probably got different set of values to all of us, leading in a different time, in a different sector, different political and economic climate. So trying to be somebody else and copy what Branson did, probably not going to serve most of us
No, it's so interesting. And I know we'll get on to some of other questions as well. But, you know, my work has been in the last decade really predominantly working with women and young women leaders. And I would say just as a yes and to this is that for women, there have been so few role models and, you know, for women to see themselves in someone out there, particularly in the business sphere. And so for them, it is important to see other ways of leading, other businesses that are created by women and so on, that they too can do that. A dear, dear old friend of mine who was the former CEO of Mozilla would say, and there are many maps, they're just not your maps.
Yeah, I love that.
And so it's great to have these examples, whether that's Branson or Martha Lane Fox or whoever it might be, and to take from it what's useful for you, but to remember you're still the one who's on your journey, needing to take your shortcuts or the long way around if you make a misturn. And that's all great. But when you maniacally say, oh, I need to be like this person, it's only going to get you so far. And I think a wash of misery too.
And I think, as you say, great to be able to take the bits that work for you from some of these other people, but equally as well, being totally cool with saying, and I'm not going to take that bit because you know what? That's not me. I've got different values. That doesn't suit me.
Totally.
So I'm going to take that, but not that.
Yep. Yeah, we get the right to choose. Absolutely. Yeah. No, seriously. It's great, Ben.
Brilliant. So you've had a fascinating career, Jane. Would you mind kind of sharing with us sort of a few of the key leadership lessons you've learned along the way that have kind of really stayed with you and might be useful and resonate with our listeners?
Yeah, thanks for asking. Yeah, and I knew you were going to ask me this question, and I'm always a little bit like, oh gosh, I'm a bit embarrassed because I feel like I'm like six different people on my resume, and like I look like I have a personality disorder, and I have done a lot of things. I mean, I started my career working on a factory floor. So I'm from the Midlands originally in Warwickshire. My mum was a hat maker. My grandmother was a hat maker, and I became a hat maker at 18.
Wow.
And so was the sadly one of the last felt making hat factories in the UK, which ended up also closing. It's been 25 years ago plus now, but that was my first job.
What sort of hats?
So, I mean, everything from, I mean, this, you know, the company was started in the 1850s off of the, and I'm ashamed to say this, but off of the back of the slave trade, because it was deemed that every slave should have a hat. And so Wilson and Stafford's, which was the company, was set up then, but also made a lot of gentlemen's hats, so top hats, pork pies. I mean, all these traditional felt hats that you might imagine a gentleman wearing at the turn of the century. they were still making. And then also a lot of fabric cloth caps. Lady Diana in the 80s sort of had this resurgence of hat making for women. So there was a lot of really fancy straw hats and things like that. And I was there in the early 90s. And that was the time of the Bosnia-Croat, Serbian-Croat war. And so they had a lot of Ministry of Defense contracts as well. So my job at the time was cutting through with about 3 inches of fur, which was the inside of the cold weather caps that they had the peacekeepers wearing. So it was, and I remember, you know, I had these blisters on my where the scissors would, you know, lie in your hands. But, you know, the I bring this up because firstly, you know, I'll tell you a little bit more and I'll hurry things up because we haven't got all day, I know. But, you know, I've written a book. I've been an entrepreneur 4 times. I've helped, been very fortunate to have some exciting roles at some really big consumer tech companies. And yet I started my career on the factory floor, and I have a lot of respect for every job that someone will do. Those men and women taught me so much about respect, about humility, about hard work, standing on your feet for 8-9 hours a day, enduring sort of the, not only sort of we sit at our computers, right, and we're tired by the end of the day, but actually physical pain, the blisters I had. Okay, it's what's blister, but you know, that's someone's job. They're doing that every single day, and we don't, I think we can forget that you know, people are using their bodies, all of their bodies in their work, and it's easy when we're in the knowledge workforce to forget about that. So a lot of humility. I got to work at, my first big job was I started working at jungle.com, which I don't know if you remember or listeners will remember. It was really the UK's big first internet success story. And so I was the 6th person to join jungle.com. We saw it was sort of a predecessor to Amazon at that time. We had a £1.5 billion valuation. And then in the April of the year 2000, boo.com went bust last minute. Didn't float for as much as they were thought it was going to float. And of course, this was sort of like the beginning of the end for the first dot-com era. And yeah. I watched Steve Bennett, who was the founder, CEO of Jungle, lose everything. And I retained my job, but I was somewhere, you know, in the sort of below middle management at that time. I was like 25. A lot of the senior leaders who were getting paid way more than me lost their jobs. We sort of let 300 people go in 24 hours. And this was an interesting lesson for me in, I got a little bit caught up with the, it was almost like showbiz, you know, at the time. Millions of dollars of investment funding. I was responsible for launch day. I had a £10 million budget for launching jungle.com with our team. And so we bought TV ads, we had radio ads, we branded the tube, you know, I mean, it was ridiculous. But I had lost sight of kind of reality. So I think, you know, it's always important to have vision and to be pushing, but also to still clearly keep your feet on the floor.
Yeah. So how did you do that going forward in subsequent jobs and kind of building businesses after that? How did that experience help you? Or what did you do to keep your feet on the floor, so to speak, after that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's always a dance of being able to have that 30,000 foot view, right? But also what you do every day matters, right? That is actually the real work. That's actually real life in the moment, to the hour, to the day. And I'm a goal oriented people. I make to-do lists every day. But when it comes to working with a team and bringing a team forward, I think having a strong vision and mission that people will follow you. I mean, I'd have followed Steve to the ends of the earth with Jungle. I mean, he was, his power to tell stories and to bring you forward and what we were trying to achieve in the UK at that time was extraordinary. I mean, and such a humble guy as well. He was, funnily enough, talking about Branson, but Steve too was dyslexic and had started the first computer magazine in the UK. I think it was called PC Pro at the time, and he'd sold it. He lived above a fish and chip shop in Coesel in Warwickshire. You know, nobody knew that, you know. And so a real humble guy with a big vision. I've always cared about sort of topics bigger than myself, so not necessarily interested in creating more small businesses. That's just where I am. But also realizing, you know, it's the people in the business that are going to make that possible. And so every single day matters, every single moment matters. So you can't just be up here in the clouds. You've got to have the rubber hit the road every single day.
Yeah, I think that's interesting what you say there around caring about bigger topics. Unfortunately, my memory fails me here and I can't remember the gentleman's name, but this morning I was listening to an episode of the High Performance Podcast. Oh, yeah. And they had the founder of the wearable tech company Whoop.
Oh, right.
So he's, I think he's early 30s, built the business as a CEO and founder. It's been his only job he's ever had. It's now valued. It's got a multi-billion dollar valuation.
Wow. Good for him. Right on.
Yeah, it's an amazing story. One of the things he was talking about was he never really set out to make money. There was a problem, a challenge that he was really, really passionate about that he wanted to solve. And through that, it said it's just so happened he's managed to build this incredible business. But I think it is important, isn't it? Kind of having that, it's that thing that you really, really care about. It's not to say there's anything wrong if your thing you care about is making loads of money, but it's potentially easier if there's a challenge or a cause that you really care about, I think.
Yeah, and I think it could be more far-reaching. I mean, Peter Diamandis, the founder of XPRIZE, would always say, if you want to make $1 billion, you solve a problem for 1 billion people. Mm. So I'm also not anti-capitalist in any way, shape, or form. But, you know, I think one of the biggest failings of mankind is that we don't think big enough at times, right? And yet, wow, like of the potential, because we see brands and we see all manner of people who've made a significant difference in the world. And Steve Jobs, I'm a quote machine this morning, but Steve Jobs would say, you know, just look around you, like somebody made this mouse, this coffee cup. And that was made by people just like you and me, right?
Yeah.
Somebody made this, somebody thought of it and made it. And I think that is so, what we really need as humans is to believe that we can do it and that we can make a change. And yeah, to be bold in that vision too, because people have done it before. They're doing it all the time. Why not you?
Yeah. And all visionaries are often ridiculed or told they're crazy to start with, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. Very much so. Yeah. And it takes there's a lot of battling through that. And that comes back to ourselves again, as we were starting our conversation, is that I think if we've focused on we've done our inside out game, and you know, we know our values and we know what we're here to do in this lifetime, it's pretty hard to give that up once that you have that knowledge and that certainty. So you're prepared to get ridiculed and, you know, stay the course.
Yeah, absolutely. Jane, let us change tack ever so slightly, because I do want to, there's one main question from your time at Mozilla that we touched on when we spoke before Christmas to set this up that I'm really fascinated to ask you about, which is really was around how do you or how did you go about sort of welcoming highly skilled, talented people into Mozilla at the time and then leading highly skilled, talented people in what is essentially a business working on a open source freelance basis, because that would probably for more and more people or people in business we're starting to work with people and employ people on that basis. So what did that look like, and what are perhaps some of the lessons that listeners can take if that's the world that they're starting to operate in? Because you was probably at Mozilla one of the first people doing that, I'd imagine.
Yeah, thank you. I love that you asked me about Mozilla. There's still, I always say, if you were to cut me open, I'd bleed Mozilla. they had such a profound impact on my life and how I see the world, and I will be forever grateful. And yeah, I joined Mozilla. It was 2007. I was employee 103. I was the first European employee. My role at the time was I was head of European marketing. We didn't have anybody really doing marketing at all, even in the US. And I remember I started the job in the October, and John Lilly, who was the CEO at the time, said to me, okay, Jane, well, we need you to work on a marketing plan for Mozilla in Europe. And I think we had about 100 million Firefox users by then. And he said to me, oh, and we, you know, you've got 6 weeks and I want to present your findings to the board. And so I did what any good marketer would do. I was like, where is the fastest growing internet populations in Europe? Because, you know, that was not everybody was on the internet then. You know, it's a different story today, 15 years later or so. There were seven big geographies, and I did all the internet population, and this is what we should focus on, and blah, blah, blah. Wrote up the presentation strategy, gave it to him. He came back to me and he was like, Jane, okay, so I see this, but there are like, Mozilla has 43 different language versions of Firefox in Europe. What are you going to do with them? I was like, what? What? I'm one person. Are you kidding me? Like, already seven geographies is a bit ridiculous. And I guess I hadn't fully grokked at the time the nature of the open source world. So, and I wanted to tee that up because we only built Firefox in English. So when I left Mozilla in the end, we had more than 90 different language versions of Firefox, which were all localized. So they were translated, they were built, they were supported, they were marketed by volunteers in all of those geographies. It was impossible to think that we could do any of our work without the support of those volunteers, of those passionate individuals. At its height, Mozilla had 500 million Firefox users in those 90 different language versions. And so, I was responsible for all of user engagement at that time. So it was this dance between trying to keep the brand, trying to have some guidance, but also giving those individuals the freedom to act and to make it their own. And this is one of the biggest lessons of my life is if you want to have a huge impact, you have to be comfortable giving up control. And when you work with thousands of volunteers or contractors, being okay with not owning every single piece is absolutely critical. It was difficult at times. People did take a little bit too much of that power, and you know, they ran their own press and marketing campaigns, and we'd find out like, oh, someone said something they shouldn't have said, and or they'd write, you know, we were encouraged to all blog publicly. Every single employee was supposed to blog every day. We had this thing called Planet Mozilla, and that the press would go there every morning and see what have the Mozilla employees written today, you know, and so all of the information inside was outside. So I lived a very sort of public life. And I love this. And I think the lessons for today being, and they're not dissimilar when you look at social media. I mean, this was, you know, 15 years ago. Living your business on the outside means, you know, that there's a certain level of transparency that you have to be comfortable with and sharing. We want to invite, I mean, I do, I want to invite people in. I don't want people to be just my customers and my clients. I want them to be part of my community. And call me naive and idealistic for that, but they will go the extra mile if they feel like they're part of your organization. Yeah. It really has been sort of the greatest honor of my life to work with some of these individuals that would spend hours of their week volunteering to, you know, create an organization, which is a nonprofit, but had coffers of about $300 million every year in revenue. But people were volunteering because of the mission, because that Mozilla was all about creating an internet, which was a public resource, openly accessible to everybody. It wasn't going to be owned by a business or a government or a big company. And so people believed in that and they wanted to support it and be part of a movement. Gosh, I could say so many things, Ben. I'm just realizing that I'm just prattling on here. I hope that's...
Yeah, it's all gold dust.
Well, just to say that, because I think one of the biggest failings, though, of Mozilla was, two big failings. People will know Firefox as it's a desktop web browser, and we were blindsided to mobile, so did not move fast enough to consider what would the mobile web mean and bring. And, you know, we're still suffering that from today, from the walled gardens of Apple and Google. But so at that time, we had a new CEO, Gary Kovacs, and he was on a mission. We've got to get mobile right. And we would have an all-hands meeting every Monday, and we'd welcome 100 new people every week. I mean, the hiring was ridiculous. And what happened was that those individuals were not onboarded into the values and the way that Mozilla worked. And we were always successful when we worked with our volunteers. I mean, they were the boots on the ground in Brazil. You know, they were our eyes and ears in Poland. We didn't know those markets. They're our community. You live there, knew those markets. And so we had a whole, like, hundreds and hundreds of people that had no idea how to work with volunteers and so were completely missing information. And also, we were still only about 1,500 employees at that time. But there's no way we could compete with Google, right? With it's supposedly that they spent $1 billion launching Google Chrome. We could never compete with that. So I do believe that that was part of Mozilla's downfall. I mean, now Firefox exists, but there's no way they have any of the impact that we used to have. And that's terribly sad.
So reading between the lines, you mentioned this piece earlier around when you are managing and leading this volunteer workforce, you have to get comfortable with the fact that you're going to have to let go of some control and you can't control everything. And then I heard you speak about when you're bringing in hundreds more people. It was part of the problem that some of those people you're bringing into the core of the organization perhaps couldn't cope with that different leadership style, and that's why they struggled. Is that fair?
Yeah, they'd had no experience of it, which is totally forgivable. But there was sort of a sea change in the organization that we inside were the ones that needed to do the job, and that outside people were not as maybe skilled, or that we needed to fix this problem. It was all hands on deck. We'd be faster to do that in the inside. And all of these, I think, were fair strategies. Only the beauty of hindsight, right, that you can see, oh, maybe we shouldn't have done that. That was a mistake. And it was hard. I mean, I remember I was chief of staff for Mitchell Baker. So I left Mozilla for a while and I went back and I was chief of staff to the chairwoman, co-founder of Mozilla, Mitchell Baker. And she tried very, very hard to start to instill and bring back this community-driven approach, more of the true open source approach. And people didn't understand it and they were afraid of it because we wanted to make sure we could control instead of creating a container for success. And I remember that leap of faith that I was doing back in 07 when I first joined. So it's not insignificant. It's just, it is a great pity. It's something I really, it makes me very sad still. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because we need Mozilla more than ever.
I think it's interesting that you mentioned that leap of faith that you took there as well, because that's a question that was forming in my mind. So when you joined Mozilla and suddenly going into this, I guess, leadership management style where you're getting comfortable not having all of the answers, perhaps not being in control of everything, like how easily did that come to you? And if the answer's not that easily, what were some of the things that you did to try and get more comfortable? The reason I ask the question is I really believe whether you work in an open source environment or, let's say, a more traditional company structure, I truly believe leaders getting comfortable, not having all the answers and relinquishing some control are some of the most powerful things we can do to free up productivity, engagement, all of that good stuff. But I don't think it always comes that naturally to people. I think often it's scary for people. So like, what was your experience and journey with that, Jane?
Yeah, I love that you're bringing that in as well, Ben. And it's true. It doesn't matter. Yeah, every day we're doing this in our small teams, our large teams. Mm. And I think, you know, I think it's partly because we're not bad people. I mean, we ultimately all want to do a good job, don't we? You know, it's actually part. It's almost Absolutely. Feels like it's because of the responsibility that we've taken on that we don't want to do a bad job, and so therefore we must control everything. And you know, at the same time, there's definitely the ego in that, which is, ooh, and if you mess up, you're the boss and you're going to get canned for it. I mean, it's definitely in the practice. I think what I have learned also is in creating more safe and brave spaces for the entire team, so that there's more of a relationship that you have with your people. It's a practice that has to happen every single day, first of all, and in cultivating relationships with your people, you're developing trust. There's a more open communication. You're more likely to see things going sideways. And so you may have an opportunity before it happens to step in. I give up all the control because people will surprise you. Yes, they'll mess up. Everybody does. We all do. But the amount of times they come and they have wowed you with something that you could have never imagined because you gave them permission, you gave them a chance, and they will come back and just completely blow it out of the water. I've had many more of those experiences than bad ones. And if you don't have the relationship and trust with your people, then it's very hard to do that.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? And I think the thing that we often forget is, yes, there's the fear that people will mess up if we relinquish some control and give them a lot more scope and freedom. But we forget as well, people will mess up if we try and control them as well.
It's no different.
People are gonna mess up kind of regardless. We're all human, right? We all make mistakes.
No, that's so true. And what's important then as a leader is to take this as a team and say, well, what did we learn? Right. Yeah. So, you know, people are always looking at what new skills can we have? What can we learn to get better? What can we understand this? But also learning backwards is so key. As a team, let's dissect what just did happen. You know, like, what could we have done differently? And doing that as a whole team, it's not just with the individual, but it's with everybody. We can all learn, right, from what's happening. One of the most important things I think we can do as leaders as well is foster this culture of learning and being willing to examine the good stuff and the bad stuff, right? And that frees us up to be able to fail and it not be a holy heck moment. Yeah.
And I loved your language there, Jane, which I'm assuming was very deliberate in that you said, what can we learn? How can we do this better? Which is very different to why did this go wrong? Or what often comes up is, whose fault was
it? Then we start the very
different, isn't it? Subtle shift in language, but it makes for a entirely different and much safer conversation, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we're all human. I mean, I know I'm just, you know, dressing this up and it's all kumbaya and what have you, but I don't know, I'd rather work in an environment where, you know, we can examine everything and we can be quite clinical with our reviews and so on, and then just get back on with the work, right? I know, again, it's important to me that people have drive and mission and purpose. And I think when we're not aligned with our mission and purpose, then we can also get resentful about these things too. And then any wonder, this is a downward spiral, but when you're working together in service of something, whatever it is, that as long as you're committed and this is what you want to do and where you want to spend your time, then, you know, we're going to get over it and then we'll get back on the horse and let's get the job done, right? Let's start moving forward again.
Jane, let me ask you about your book. So you've recently written a new book, Unlocked. Can you tell us a little bit about why you wrote it, kind of the premise of the book, what we can expect to find within its pages?
Thank you. Thanks for asking me about the book too. It's actually my first book. I mean, I had written a little bit before, but not a book. I didn't know I knew so many words. It was quite an experience. And I was compelled to write the book, as there'll be many books come out, of course, during the global pandemic. This was in the early summer of 2020. And I've founded an organization which empowers young women leaders in social change 8 years ago. And I was absolutely despondent at the numbers women going backwards, women's progress going backwards. We lost, apparently the World Economic Forum said, we lost 36 years of progress in 2020. And that was due to women leaving the workforce in droves twice as fast as men. We had, we still have the lowest number of women in the workforce since 30 years. Whether we had also the number of domestic violence going up, we had the number of girls that go to school around the world dropping by millions. I mean, this is impossible. It's absolutely impossible that this has happened. And we had very slim gains as it was when you look at women's careers, women's pay, women's rights. I mean, I could just go on and on, Ben. But here I was, utterly depressed. And I run an organization that supports women, right? So I'm like, oh my God, if I'm feeling like this, how is the woman who's had to quit her job to take care of her family? And that was not, you know, her decision. It was probably a family's decision, because men just happened to earn more than women and have more senior positions than women. So it just made sense that she would stay home. So they talk about the great resignation, and I'm like, well, not because of choice, not all because of choice. So I started having more conversations with women in my network for myself to kind of check in what's happening, who's doing what are we doing about this? And was really uplifted actually by some of the most incredible women working to advance women and girls. And all of these news stories, you know, I read The Guardian diligently. And so every morning there'd be some horror story about women's rights again. And I was just done. I was like, okay, I'm going to start and write and chronicle some of the stories of the women today who are working to advance women and girls. And so that's everything from Colonel Candace Frost, who's the US Army's glass ceiling breaker, to Tracy Charles at the age of 26, kicked off the diversity debate for Silicon Valley, women and minorities in technology, and to tell their stories, and to also to show that each of these people started with incredibly small actions. And it's more than 100 years since women got the vote. And clearly what we've been doing isn't working in terms of getting equality. And so I believe that it's always been in the small actions that change will happen. So the first half of the book is inspiration and telling stories of how these small actions by women are making a massive difference to women and girls around the world. The second half of the book are 10 keys, which each of us can do every day to help assist to rise and to try very hard to claw back not only what we've lost during the global pandemic, but to work towards ending the disparities in gender equity once and for all. So yeah, big vision with it. And back to here's my big vision, but here are the 10 actions. Here are some things that you can do, easy, repeatable, every day, that will make a difference, I promise you.
Yeah, and that's just what I was going to ask, actually, coming down from the big vision to some of the actions. What would you say are perhaps some small actions, some steps that leaders or leadership teams can take, regardless of what their gender and the current gender makeup of the leadership team is right now? Like, what are some of the things that business leaders can be doing? And I guess perhaps for the slightly more cynical, probably, let's face it, slightly more cynical male leaders, why should they care?
It's like a red rag to a bull when you say that.
I thought it might.
Are you kidding me? I'm kidding me.
I thought it might be, but I wanted to ask the question, because there'll be people sitting there listening who go, who'll be asking that question.
Well, you know, women are 51% of the population. More women than men graduate from college these days. Armfuls of data which show that more women in your executive team will increase your bottom line. More women on your board will do the same. Diverse teams increase creativity. More women in your company and in leadership teams will increase your retention of employees, and more harmonious teams, which means more happier teams, more productive teams. So there's a slew of data which says that we should be hiring more women and we should be hiring more people of color. It's just crystal clear. And so to those who are despondent, I'm going to ask you to check in with yourself for bias and unconscious bias or conscious bias, but definitely there's some inside out work for you to take a peek at.
I think one of the things with unconscious bias that a previous guest on the podcast said was, the thing with unconscious bias, Ben, is a lot of the time it's not actually that unconscious.
Yeah, it's, well, I mean, you have to just take, for example, I spent a dozen years living in Silicon Valley. So the amount of investment funding, venture capital funding that goes to women-led startups at its height was 2.4%.
Wow.
At its height, for millions and billions of dollars on an annual basis getting invested in companies, 2.4%. And It was 2.1%. I don't think we have the numbers yet for last year, but for 2020, it shrank to 2.1%. And yet also evidence says that if you invest in women-led businesses, your return on investment will be far greater. Wow. Than. So it can, in my mind, it can only be bias. It can only be bias that is preventing 97.9% of that money not being invested in women-led businesses.
Anyway, I think when you hear that stat, you really start to understand sort of your opening sort of statement on this when you're talking about some of that World Economic Forum kind of research about progress and losing progress and your point around 100 years since women got the vote in the UK. You think actually that's very little progress has been made when you hear stats like that. 2.4% is just unbelievable.
It is. And I have to tell you, when I was writing the book and researching, the book has a lot of research in there, I was crying a lot. I knew it was bad. I didn't know it was that bad. And one of the most wonderful things that's happened from writing this book is that I wrote this book for women. I have to tell you, Ben, I would say I did not write it for men. And the amount of men that have bought the book, read it, left me reviews and so on, because they also did not understand, did not know all of these various challenges that women are facing today. And still we carry on. So I've so appreciated so many incredible male allies and working to assess what they might do in their businesses. To come back to your question about what can we do in our business. So a few of the highlights, I think, that we can pay attention to, and both men and women, network is so critical, I think. So we do not, as women, we often don't have a lot of time, but one of the things that we undervalue, I think, is our networks. And one of the best things you can do for a young woman in particular is to teach her the value of network and to open your network, to make introductions. Mm. We're very good at forming internal relationships inside companies. That's great, but our external network, which of course grows over time, is a very different situation for women. And then, you know, we know that our networks, the weak ties, these weak connections, are the ones that will create opportunities that we haven't seen. You know, we can only, within our close-knit communities and networks, we're not likely to hear of something new, a new job, a new project, a new business development opportunity, etc. So
that's fascinating. I never would have thought that. That thought never would have crossed my mind that was the case.
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. There's, in fact, Herminia Ibarra at London Business School has been an expert on women in networking since the late 80s. And if you look up any of her research, I do quote her quite a bit in the book, what she talks about is something called homophily, which is that we will tend to hang out with and connect with people who look like us. And so this is one of the biggest challenges within companies, is that women don't get hired into roles because, let's say, the majority are men who are making the hiring decisions. Mm. So they will look to others. It's the same thing, I believe, by the way, with the startup venture funding as well. So when you only see other people that look like you, you only bring others into that same circle. So men will do this externally because there are men that look like them still. But for women, it's incredibly hard to find other women that look like them as well outside. So need to give them a nudge, because also it can feel a little bit dirty, actually, for women to network. It feels transactional. It feels, you know, I'm trying to get something from you and maybe I don't have as much to give you back. And so I just don't do it because it feels like I'm just taking and taking. And we're very conscious as women about the balance of value. But at the same time, women are fantastic connectors. So what we can change the visual, the perspective on networking to be connecting, then we're much more open to meeting new folks and maybe asking for help. The other big piece, well, there's two big pieces, and I what I call send the elevator down as well. So if we have reached a position of power and privilege in the organization, it doesn't necessarily mean you're the CEO or the vice president or what have you, but if you have some influence, let's be looking and making the journey up the mountain easier for the young women around you.
I love that.
Yeah,
and that's leadership, right? That's a definition of leadership.
Yeah, McKinsey and Lean In, they do Women in the Workplace study every year for the last 6 years. The one number that kills me that has not moved. So if you look at VP roles, something like 22%, 20-something percent, it's getting there. Not great, but getting there. The one number that has not shifted in 6 years is the number of first-time women leaders.
Right.
So for every 100 young men that reach that management first management position, only 81 white women, and something like 70 something for black women and 50 something for Latino women. And that hasn't shifted. They call it the broken rung.
Right.
So we've got to look at who is getting hired, who's getting promoted very early in the career. Because when we do turn around and we're like, well, there's no women candidates for a vice president role. Well, that happened way back because that woman had to work five times as hard to get her first management position, right? And time matters. So look at your young women and their roles, as well as bringing more women into your executive suite too.
Wow, powerful stuff. Jane, a couple of quick fire questions to wrap up if we can. What do you think are three key traits for leaders right now?
I think inclusive leadership is critical, is absolutely critical. We need to be welcoming of all peoples, all skills, all perspectives, backgrounds. And that points to what we were saying before about creative teams, about productive teams. So inclusive leadership, also a lot of empathy. I mean, during the pandemic, I think the good thing is there's a lot more empathy around with the relationships between managers and staff, and empathy for ourselves, by the way, as well. Focusing on our team's well-being and their health. If you don't have a well team, you don't have a team. So we have to work on that. And then finally, you might call it adaptability or agility, but I don't know who's making plans these days. I mean, we're dealing with uncertainty and trying to figure out the way forward. Even to plan for 3 months, never mind a year, is hard. So learning to dance in the moment, to not be attached to plans, I think is a critical skill.
I love that. And what is the one book or a book that has really had a significant impact upon you?
Yeah, there's been a lot. When you asked me this, I was trying to think, and it's a lovely
book. It's hard to narrow down, right?
Wow, it really is. And then I've set myself a goal this year of reading 50 books. I wasn't reading enough. I mean, I do read, but I was too busy writing a book for 2 years. So I was like, I'm going to read again, but I've realized that it's quite a skill to read. You know, having the patience these days to sit down and read. So I'm working on reading books again. The one I wanted to share with you and your listeners was, I don't know if you've ever heard of Stephen Pressfield. He wrote the War of Art.
Yes.
And that is quite a tome, and it's great. So definitely that. But he then wrote a much shorter version of the same book, basically called Do the Work. And I don't know how many times myself and my husband have gifted this book. It's really about getting out of your own way. It's the easiest thing I can say about it. But about, you know, what holds us back, the fear of shipping, the fear of, you know, actually putting yourself out in the world. And it's such a short, fun, beautifully written book, easy digestible. I read it once a year, give yourself a good reminder, and share it with everyone you love, because it really is. He's a fabulous author. I do appreciate
Amazing.
Everything he says.
And is there one item, piece of kit, an object that you can't live without, or kind of really serves you well?
You know, I'm going to take a liberty here, because I did think long and hard about this, and I'm just not that materially driven. I'm really not. I was like, God, what? So tragic thing, but here in Boulder, we had a terrible fire just over a week ago. 1,000 people have lost their houses. Terrible wildfire. And these people have lost everything. I mean, absolutely every single thing they have. And so my husband and I have been talking about what would we take with us, you know, and our dog. But pretty much there's not much. I mean, things you have to take, you know, your documents, but it's okay as long as we have each other and we have our dog.
Well, it's a pretty special place to be.
It is. There's a lot of gratitude right now. There's a lot of sadness where we are, but that is, there's not Not much. As long as we have each other, we can start again, I hope. Yeah.
What an amazing place to wrap up our conversation.
Thank you.
Jane, thank you so much for your time. It's probably one of the longest, if not the longest, episode I've done.
Oh my God, sorry.
But the time has flown by. So thank you. Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed chatting to you. I'm sure everybody listening is going to get so much value from it. So thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, I do hope so. Thank you. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
There you have it, folks, my conversation with Jane Finette. As always, I really hope you enjoyed the episode, but most importantly, I really hope you're able to go away and make some small positive changes as a result. Before you do anything else, do also please go and check out eStyly. Take a look at their e-bikes. They really are fantastic. And if you are getting value from the podcast, please do head over to wherever you're getting your podcast from, wherever you're listening, and rate the show and leave a review. It really does make a huge difference to us and enables us to keep bringing you more and more episodes. If you do leave a review, please just take a screenshot of that review, send it across to me via email to chat@ben-morton.com. And we'll reply, giving you complimentary access to my weekly planning protocol online course. That's it for this episode, folks. Hope you've enjoyed it. Take care. See you next time, and lead on.